This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Here is a not unserious question on a Friday afternoon. Do we think the economy can take a real October surprise? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, quite the eventful Friday, as it happens, the 28th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The theme of the next 4.5 minutes of this radio program is going to be, that was interesting. And it's going to be a conversation that ranges across topics both political and economic to do it. We've got Lynette Lopez from Business Insider, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. She is in New York. He is in Washington. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Sudeep, let me start with you and the political news of the day. The letter from FBI Director James Comey saying that he had new information related to the Hillary Clinton email investigation. It turns out to have been, according to the New York Times, emails from either Anthony Weiner's phone or Huma Abedin's phone. She, of course, is a Clinton advisor. Point being that when that news broke, it was 10 o'clock in the morning our time, 1 o'clock for you guys on the East Coast. The Dow lost 100-something points, not huge, but it was a straight-up drop. The VIX, the anxiety index, it is sometimes called, shot up. What are we to make of the jitteriness going into this election?
If you bet that Hillary Clinton's emails would be the thing that moved the stock market at the end of October, you win. But nobody bet that. Markets have been expecting since early October, when we got the Trump tapes and all of his issues with women, markets bet that Hillary Clinton would become president of the United States. It was over for him, and it was not quite a one-way bet, but pretty close to it across the board. And markets are built around certainty. Mm-hmm. When there is uncertainty, when anything changes, not just the traders, but their computer systems, the algo systems, all react to it, and they're going to respond. They responded immediately, obviously, and then you had some actual human decision-making come in instead of just artificial intelligence. And once that comes through, people will think, oh, well, maybe it's not going to change all that much. But this does scramble a little bit of the calculus about not just the presidency, but the House and Senate races, and is it still in a slam dunk for Democrats on certain seats, and all of that matters, and it will definitely matter over the next 10 days.
Lynette, talk to me. 10, 11 days, where are we?
You know, I still think we're in the same place we were before. The market came back. We'll see what's in those emails. They've been through tens of thousands of them.
Yeah.
And if they find something, I will be even more shocked than I was when this news came out today. Far more shocked than I was when I heard that awful Donald Trump tape. I will be more shocked than I was, probably at any point in my life.
So, Lynette, let's stick with the topic then. Straight up economic. Gross domestic product came out this morning, 2.9% in the most recent quarter, with a proviso that this is going to get revised one way or the other. Surprisingly strong. Sort of, that happened.
Surprisingly strong. We like that. We like good news. It's not, it's definitely not what Donald Trump wanted to hear today, though, he gets handed bad news about the economy all the time and pivots to something about himself. But, 2.9 GDP growth is not that great. In reality,
but given
the
where
best we've gotten
right,
in a couple years,
yeah.
And so hey, why not? Let's take it. Let's embrace it. Love it.
Sudeep, hey, why not? 2.9%.
Hey, why not? We'll take anything we can get right now. We've had most of this expansion. We're now in the eighth year of the economic expansion. It's been roughly 2% growth for the entire time. When you move past the volatility quarter to quarter, it's basically the same kind of economic growth pace throughout most of this period. And we're not getting a whole lot better than that. And Trump might talk about 4 or 5% growth. This is not the kind of demographics that are going to give you something amazing. But we're also not completely falling apart. So at least we should
But we should also remember that
Yeah, go ahead, Lynette.
This isn't even growth. Yep. It's not the same for everyone in America. And that's what that's the wrinkles that we have to iron out following this election with policy. But over the past couple of years, we haven't really done that.
Right. So let me throw that question to you, Lynette, with 45 seconds left, plus or minus. The evening out of that discrepancy in economic growth is going to fall to the next president, whoever that may be. But they will take office with a large chunk of this electorate feeling disenfranchised both economically and politically. Where do they go?
That is a question that I certainly can't answer as somebody who likes to follow the numbers. What I do know is that both candidates are people who want to increase infrastructure spending.
Yep.
Trump wants to do it while also at the same time cutting taxes, which is like a mathematical conundrum. But they both want to invest in America again.
Yep.
So I think that Hillary is a practiced technocrat. She hopefully will be able to get bills through Congress, especially in a more friendly Senate. So we shall see. But investing in America, that's the hot new thing.
Yeah.
Future preference. Lynette, what we can do for tomorrow.
Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, Sadiq Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. 10 days. Wall Street, we discussed already. Everything was pretty much calmed down by the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to spend some time on the program today talking about manufacturing, which, despite reports of its demise, is still a force in the American economy. About 12% of gross domestic product, according to the Federal Reserve, is what it makes up. That's even with all the jobs that have gone overseas and technology having changed how we make things. Los Angeles, as it happens, about as far from the Rust Belt as you can get, is the biggest manufacturing hub in this country. More than 500,000 jobs here, making almost everything. Goldbreck Systems USA is in Culver City. It's about 11 miles west of Marketplace World headquarters in downtown. The main facility is a clean, well-lit production floor, 32 workers running computerized cutting machines.
It's basically a computer-programmed system that is extremely precise and almost like a robot, if you want.
They make high-end, and I mean really high-end, oversized windows, advanced sliding glass doors, glass walls, really.
There you go.
And the like.
Yeah, so we're doing the actual cutting right here on these machines, and they need to be cut to size. To the size of the actual window system required for a particular residence.
Right.
We make sliding glass walls for luxury residences. It's an expensive system to make.
James Shortner is the CEO.
And that's because using glazing as a structural component is a very expensive way to build a window, but a very beautiful one.
Is glazing a fancy way to say glass?
It is.
Okay, all right.
It is.
I got to make sure I understand the vernacular here. All of these guys working here,
yes.
Are they straight out of high school? Do they have college? What kind of training do they have?
It's a mix of high school and college. So depending on what you do, if you're basically just a helper and you're moving around things from A to B and sorting things, typically those gentlemen here would have a high school degree. Whereas when you're actually operating these CNC machines, you're doing a bit of programming. You have to enter everything very precisely. You have to do some calculating, a lot of thinking. You need some training for that.
Give me a sense of your labor challenge. When you need to hire people to do either the machining or, some of the lower tech kind of things.
Right.
How does it go when you post a job? Do you get applicants right away?
We do. But unfortunately, we get a lot of applicants who do not really qualify.
Huh.
We find it hard to find the people with the right training. We would hope for a bit of a reform in the education system where, the quality level is really brought up. And I think that's very important for Los Angeles in general, or the whole country, with competition, manufacturing competition coming from Asia, where my personal feeling is people tend to be more qualified. You can't keep jobs with unskilled labor, with an unskilled labor force. And I think we have too much of that in this city for sure. And not enough is being done in that respect as far as I'm concerned.
What happens to your business if we as an economy don't get those parts of the equation right? What happens here in this shop?
In this particular shop, we would start using more machines to replace the people because the machines take more care, they're more precise, they're more reliable. The machine is programmed, so it's educated. And that's really what's going to happen.
And fewer people would have jobs.
Yes, that's right. Now, in our case, we would never have our production go to China, for example. That's the big thing, right? Everybody's scared.
Yeah, so why is that not good for you?
It doesn't make sense for us. We're too far away from our market. You know, we might have a factory there that will take care of the Chinese market. Just like this factory just takes care of North America, we have another one in Europe, or several in Europe, one in Switzerland that takes care of the Swiss and the German market. So that wouldn't make sense for shipping and logistic purposes. But I can imagine a lot of products, unlike ours, where lead time is not such a big concern, where you can stock the product as it is in a warehouse, those jobs are going to go to China.
Show me around some more. What else should I see here?
Well, we do all the cutting on these ones over here. We have two machines for that. We recently, because we're expanding and the products become so popular, we had to add extra machines.
So business is good.
It's very, very good at the moment. I mean, we've doubled in sales in a year, just to give you an example. So it's now really exploding. And that's making it a bit difficult for us to, you know, get qualified people when you're growing so fast. So we almost have to put a handbrake on a little bit, and we could grow faster, quite honestly, if we could get more qualified people. That's how extreme it is.
Obviously, the reason we're talking about manufacturing today is because jobs have become maybe the key economic issue in this election.
We're going to bring your jobs back. We're going to bring your companies back.
I want us to have the biggest jobs program since World War II.
We're going to bring jobs back from China.
Jobs in infrastructure and advanced manufacturing.
Mr. Trump, Secretary Clinton there on the trail at various points in the past year or so. But let's play out that thread here, all right? What would it take to convince a company to bring back just one manufacturing job from, I don't know, Asia, for instance? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on that one.
If you want to know what it takes to bring a manufacturing job back to the U.S., the best place to start is with someone who's done it.
We're on the factory floor of the Rodon Group, a high-volume plastic injection molder where we manufacture parts for Kinect toys.
Jill Wirth is a spokesperson for the Rodon Group. She's in Hatfield, Pennsylvania.
And what we're hearing are blue rods that are coming off the injection molding belt.
The Rodon Group and Kinect build toys you might have heard of.
Kinect's branded products, Tinker Toys, and Lincoln Logs.
Michael Arreton is CEO of Kinect, and back in the late 90s, it shifted most of its production to China.
The savings were dramatic, in the range of 40 to 70% in some cases. Primarily, it was labor costs, although it was really a lot of the supply chain. You know, China in particular subsidized the factories, subsidized the trucks to get things back and forth.
Then, in 2009, Kinect did exactly what the presidential candidates want companies to do. It brought 90% of its production back. Why? Well, because all those pluses in China had started to fade away.
As labor costs were going up in China, as they're sort of morphing from a pure exporter to a more consumption-based economy, the savings start to disappear.
Wages in China have been climbing for more than a decade, at sometimes 15% a year, while state subsidies have declined. Other costs became more noticeable.
So, for example, you've got to carry more inventory if you're making things coming from China, just because it takes another month to get here than if you're making it here. Double layers of management, because you need management here and overseas. You have less flexibility in terms of what you would want to make to meet market demand.
Now, most of the companies bringing jobs back, these are companies selling to the U.S. market.
Part of the reason you're not seeing more reshoring is that a lot of those manufacturers that went to China for low-cost reasons have actually found a market there.
Craig Giffey is vice chairman of the automotive industry practice at Deloitte. He says there's a limit to how many jobs are coming back.
At this point, I think manufacturing reshoring is a relatively small component of manufacturing job growth in the U.S.
So what would it take to bring more jobs back from China? Well, here's the thing. You got to ask, which jobs do we actually want back?
There are two types of manufacturing jobs.
Nick Bloom is a professor of economics at Stanford.
There are a low wage, low skill, frankly, quite dangerous manufacturing jobs. And we lost millions of those in the 2000s. To bring back the low wage, low skill jobs, you basically have to cut American wages to below the level of our competitors in East Asia. And I really don't think that's what we want to be doing.
Then there are highly skilled jobs. These are jobs that are coming back and they are associated with automation. Again, Kinect CEO Michael Arreton.
the companies here that are involved in manufacturing have typically invested in a lot more automation than the ones in China. It takes away the large advantage that China has, which is their low cost of labor.
This automation creates skilled jobs, but fewer of them. And you can see this if you go to the Rodon Group factory where Ayrton makes his toys. Spokesperson Jill Wirth again.
So because we are so highly automated, we have about 110 presses here at the Rodon Group and only about 8 operators on the floor.
In a world where manufacturing jobs are fewer and higher tech, bringing them back requires a different workforce than in the past.
Number one is to strengthen our skilled workforce.
Harry Moser is president of the Reshoring Initiative, which advocates for returning jobs to the U.S.
We have lots of communications and philosophy majors and not enough toolmakers, precision machinists, welders, chemical technicians.
Michael Ayrton, CEO of Kinex, he agrees with this.
We have a talent shortage.
He talks about this with a CEO friends. There's one who works for an auto manufacturer.
And they're opening up a plant in Indiana, or they opened up a plant, and, you know, and they were looking for 1,000 engineers, and, you know, and they could only find 100.
Invest in skilled workers. It's not the catchiest or quickest slogan for a campaign, but it's the reality. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I never realized that I loved the company until I started seeing these buildings come down.
How it feels when you work someplace most of your life and then watch it get torn down. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 8 points today, less than a percent, closed at 18,161. The NASDAQ down 25 points, about a half percent, 5190. The S&P 500 slipped 6 points, 0.3%, 21 and 26. For the 5 days gone by, the S&P 500 fell 0.7%. The Dow Jones up 0.1%. The NASDAQ off 1.3%. You know how everybody got all wound up about Apple getting rid of headphone jacks in the latest phones? Folks at Cirrus Logic are pretty happy. They make the technology that goes into those fancy new wireless earbuds. They released great earnings. Shares hit some high notes, up 6.8% today. Amazon warned holiday profits might be down. That spooked some investors today. Halloween's Monday, you know. Shares off 5.1%. Bond prices up just a hair. The yield on the 10-year T-note down 1.84%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There were some new rules out this week around consumer privacy online. The Federal Communications Commission has ruled that internet service providers, Comcast and AT&T, Charter, are some names you might know. The FCC says they now must ask consumers permission to use sensitive data that they routinely collect, information those companies use to target advertising. They are still going to collect the information, mind you, even if they can't necessarily use it the way they once did. And those who are looking for complete anonymity online, they're going to have to readjust their expectations, as Gigi Duban reports.
Every second you're on the internet, ISPs like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast are collecting tons of information on you. The FCC considers some of it sensitive.
Things like social security numbers, information related to children, app usage, the content of your communications.
Jonah Berger teaches marketing at the Wharton School. He says even if consumers opt out, ISPs will still collect it. They just won't be able to sell it to third parties like advertisers. Jeff Chester is executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. He says one example of the kind of sensitive info ISPs and advertisers want is our location.
They see huge profits ahead by being able to say, well, we know that, you know, Joe and Jane just went into the store and looked at product X, and we're going to make sure they see an ad when they go home and turn on the TV or their PC.
AT&T and Comcast say the new regulations will only confuse consumers, who will still see targeted ads from companies like Google and Apple. They aren't required to ask for permission. Brian Weiser is an analyst with Pivotal Research. He says to push consumers to agree to share their data, ISPs could offer discounts.
But it's also then a carrier would say, well, gee, then you have to pay more for your service if you want the data sharing free version.
Weiser says that's probably not going to happen anytime soon. But if ISPs band together, it's not that far out there. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
What you share and click on online tells marketers a whole lot about your lifestyle. Could that data be used to predict who you're going to vote for as well? We built a quiz to test the theory. You can take it at marketplace.org. The Obama administration has had no warm feelings for for-profit colleges, especially the ones that are alleged to have lured students in with promises of jobs, only to leave them with worthless degrees and debt they can't pay. Corinthian colleges and ITT Tech might come to mind. To that end, the Department of Education is out with some new rules today, taking aim at what it calls predatory colleges and spelling out how the former students of those schools might qualify for debt relief. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Since Corinthian colleges collapsed last year amid allegations of fraud, the Education Department has agreed to discharge $247 million in former students' loans. And today it announced new rules for handling such claims in the future.
The announcements today include many wins for students.
Jennifer Wang with the Institute for College Access and Success says those wins include automatic debt relief for students whose colleges close, and schools will no longer be able to force students to sign away their right to sue if they have complaints. Wang says many for-profit colleges require private arbitration.
Schools were using this secretive tribunal to really put their students at a disadvantage and to hide fraud and abuse.
The regulations apply to students who borrow starting July of next year. Ann Bowers represented students in the rulemaking process.
It's a start, but it's nowhere near enough. And they have not granted near the relief needed for the Corinthian students, including myself.
The industry isn't happy either. Steve Gunderson is president of the trade group Career Education Colleges and Universities. He says the new regulations will crush career education by requiring schools at risk of closing to post a letter of credit proving they can cover the cost of discharged loans.
The reality is that banks will not provide this kind of automatic letter of credit.
Gunderson says it's too soon to say if his group will sue to block the regulations, as it has with other rules. He says he's still getting through all 900-plus pages. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We were in Rochester, New York, a couple of months ago for a story about manufacturing in this economy, about how it's changed and what's happened to the people who used to make their livelihoods in it. We went to Rochester because that's where Kodak is, the fifth most valuable brand in the world back in the day, bankrupt in 2012. 6,500 people work there today, 150,000 worldwide a generation ago. So today, a story of a guy who was at Kodak for 35 years.
My name is Kevin Armstrong, and I started at Kodak about 1972. At that time, for a kid that wasn't college-bound, Kodak was the place to go. My dad worked there. My stepdad worked there. Your neighbor to the right, your neighbor to the left. Kodak was the place to work, and that's just the way it was. It was the center of the world for us. Shift work itself is hard on you. I mean, they used to say you can take 10 years right off the top of your life. But, you know, we had so many good friends. When you work shift work like that, your whole world is those people that you work shift work with, the guys that are on your shift. If I went hunting, I went hunting with guys from work. If I went fishing, I went fishing with guys from work. That's where I spent my life. I'll tell you what, as a single guy, I really had it made. I had a nice home. I could take care of my family. I always drove a new car. If I wanted to go on a fancy vacation, I was able to do that. I wouldn't have made that income anyplace else. Not with the skills that I had. My last 15 years there, it was terrible because not only were there actual layoffs, but there were always rumors. I mean, the rumor mill just went on nonstop. You never knew who was going to be next. I saw an awful lot of people with 25 and 30 years in the company get laid off. And geez, these are people with families and mortgages. And you knew your coworkers, you know, this was going to happen. And at the same time, you felt lucky. Oh, they missed me on another go-round. I retired in December of 2007. We used to say that guys bled Kodak yellow. I was never one of those guys. I never realized that I loved the company until I started seeing these buildings come down. And it's emotional. I drive through these southern tier towns, I see one town after another, the main streets are all boarded up. The factories that supported those communities are gone. It's really sad. Really, really sad.
We talked to Kevin as part of our series on this election in the American economy. It's called How the Deck is Stacked. We got the story from Rochester and all the other work we've done in that series at our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a no-nonsense practical use for social media, and it comes no less from the TSA, the much-derided Transportation Security Administration. How many times have you wondered whether you can bring something through airport security? A lot, right? So, get this. All you have to do is take a picture of whatever it is you want to bring on the plane, tweet it or Instagram it to @AskTSA, and they will answer you at 8 a.m., 10 p.m. weekends, Eastern Time, 9 a.m., 7 p.m. weekends, and holidays. All right, Friday afternoon, we are out of here. The Dow off 8 points today. The NASDAQ down 25 points. The S&P 500 slipped 6 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Star Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see y'all on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. All right? This is APN.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.